You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. XG, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McCollum. Digital rights management is back in the news again this week, stirred up by Apple boss Steve Jobs. In a speech to industry on February the 6th, he said some have called for Apple to open the digital rights management system that Apple uses to protect its music against theft, so that music purchases from iTunes can be played on digital devices purchased from other companies and protected music purchased from other online stores can be played on iPods. For listeners unsure of what digital rights management is, simply it's an electronic system designed to stop people sharing files, and in this case, music files between computers, iPods and the like. In what seems to be an unrelated announcement, music label EMI said last Friday that it is planning to release a large portion of its music catalogue for sale by download without technological protection against piracy. Coincidental? I'm sure the conspiracy theorists amongst you are slightly suspect of all of this. So we thought it time to revisit one of our pet hates, digital rights management.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Justin Dunlop joins the panel to tell us all about the new technological lineup from Apple. Vista spores yet another clone. This time we see the release of Vista for mobile devices. Apple boss Steve Jobs urges the top four record companies to unprotect their music. And what's in a password? Well, plenty, as we find out in a new study about weak passwords. And Vista Security? Well, that's found somewhat wanting. All that and more on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But before all that, let's find out what's been making news in the IT world this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
Today on Tech Talk News, Windows Mobile clones a Vista look, Apple boss Steve Jobs urges record companies to drop music digital rights management, hackers hit key net servers, and Firefox claws away at the old Internet Explorer. This is Tech Talk News. News Corporation chief Rupert Murdoch says over 10% of the media company's sales are likely to come from its digital businesses, from the internet to mobile phones in 5 years. Mr. Murdoch said at the McGraw-Hill Media Summit in New York, the view excludes internet properties owned by its local newspapers, such as the New York Post's NewYorkPost.com site, whose split of digital revenue could well go higher. He said it's probably the biggest profit driver News Corp has, referring to digital businesses such as the popular social network MySpace. Revenue from sites including MySpace is expected to account for about 2% of News's final 2007 sales. Microsoft has unveiled a new version of its Windows operating system for mobile devices, making it look more like Windows Vista, called Windows Mobile 6, and available in the second quarter of 2007. It introduces the ability to view emails in their original HTML internet format, with live web links from smartphones. Windows Mobile 6 also includes Windows Live, which allows instant messaging with more than one person at one time and can send a file or image or record or send voice notes. Windows Mobile 6 users can also view, navigate and edit documents in original Word, Outlook, Excel and PowerPoint formats without affecting tables, images or text. Apple chief Steve Jobs has urged the four major record companies to start selling music online without copy protection software known as digital rights management. Mr. Jobs said there appeared to be no benefit to the record companies to continue to sell more than 90% of their music without DRM on compact discs, while selling the remaining small percentage of their music encumbered with a digital rights management system. Jobs said if such requirements were removed, the music industry might experience an influx of new companies willing to invest in the innovative new stores and players, which could only be seen as a positive by the music companies. Hackers mounted a successful 12-hour attack on 3 of the 13 root name servers that help direct global internet traffic. The attack is thought to be the largest of its kind since 9 root name servers were hit in October 2002. The report said the US Department of Homeland Security was monitoring what it described as anomalous internet traffic, but the department said there was no evidence to suggest an imminent threat to computer systems. The distributed denial of service, or DOS attacks, were largely unnoticed by internet users. And finally this week, according to research in NelsonNet Ratings, more than a fifth of Australians now use the Mozilla Firefox web browser, even though site compatibility issues mean it sometimes must be used in conjunction with Microsoft's Internet Explorer. In a report detailing Australian internet use in 2006, Nelson reported that Microsoft's Internet Explorer was still dominant in the market, with an 81% share. Firefox accounted for 22% of the market, while Apple's Safari was the third most popular at just 5%. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Optus last week announced $800 million is going to be put aside for 3G.
Going to this area, knowing that it was sort of out back a bit, and you didn't carry
outback?
A CDMA
it's
3 phone.
Hours south of Sydney.
True, out back, yeah.
We're sort of starting to make a bit of a carbon emission sense here, I think, in our environmentally friendly or unfriendly world.
Fantastic. So you don't need to be a Windows or a Mac user to get value out of it.
Absolutely.
It's great.
Now, I've had lots of fun with Ubuntu. It is a Linux operating system, and it's designed for PCs, so it's an alternative operating system to Windows.
Which that'll be definitely one to watch, yeah.
Wasn't there some issue with it only being used in the States?
They're only licensed to have the music in the States, so record companies here aren't getting their cut.
Yeah. I think you adapt to that fairly quickly, don't you?
You do.
Vista was released, which we'll talk about in a sec.
Was it?
Yep, and that's what most people said.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step 1. Download and install some podcatching software, like iTunes. Step 2. Find the address of the Tech Talk Radio podcast feed on the Tech Talk Radio website. Step 3. Copy and paste the feed address into your podcatching software. And you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever, and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
visiting the relatives, washing the car.
The panel with Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, and Graham Callaghan.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Joining me on the panel, as was just so duly introduced, Dr. Ron. Very good evening to you. Whoops.
Evening, Andrew. There was a good at the front of that. That's all right, though.
It was a good. Sorry, last minute mic change before we came on air tonight.
With about 8.5 seconds to spare, but we got there in the end, didn't we? How are you this week?
Oh, look, pretty darn good. Yeah. It's been absolutely feral at work at the moment. I think in the technological world of television and internet and web, everybody wants everything yesterday, and they're coming through the door, and anyone want a job?
You've got lots on at the moment.
Oh, sums up my week, and doing a lot of television commercials for some, you know... Yep, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's been good. And very your week, good. You're on holidays again, I think.
We were on holidays.
We were discussing this the other day on the telephone, weren't we? I think we were calling it... what do you have to do these days when you're an employee? You have these things... Liabilities, what do you call it?
Mental health.
No. I'm trying to think of the word that they call it. But anyway, you're not on holidays, you're on that other leave so that they get rid of their...
Where they force you to take your annual leave so that you don't... it's not a liability to the employer.
That's right, right. So yeah, you're on one of those leaves. Enjoying your 5 days off?
It's going to go fast, yeah. it's only the 5 days, but anyhow, it's been a busy week in tech, hasn't it?
It has, lots happening too. And tonight, I've been looking forward to tonight because Justin's coming in to join us very shortly because Apple's done all sorts of things. And released a lot of new toys, so we're going to find out all about it. Graham Callaghan. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Andrew.
How's tricks in your neck of the world been? Are you inundated technologically, as I think everybody else is
well,
at the moment?
Yeah, frequently, almost always inundated these days.
Yeah, no, I just judging the fact that you came screaming in the studio after it even started tonight, so I figured you're obviously very busy.
I was here before the panel intro rolled.
He just built a radio station in about 45 seconds. It was quite impressive to watch, actually.
It's not the first time.
No, it's not. It won't be the last.
Ah, dear. So, emails and things this week. Dr. Ron, you've got one over there. I've got one over here. Would you like to go first?
first?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I do have some feedback this week. Hello to Dr. John. Now, Dr. John didn't actually email us or post on the forum, but he's an analyst programmer for the Department of Health in Adelaide in South Australia.
And hello, he listens to Dr. John?
Dr. John. He listens to Tech Talk
Ron's
Radio.
With Ron.
Yeah, it does, on his video iPod. He's got a 30-gig video iPod. So, g'day, John, and thanks for listening. Glad you enjoy the show.
Now, how did you find him? How did you come across this? Because he didn't email us.
No, he didn't email us. No, I tripped over his blog while I was doing some surfing.
I'm a fan of blogs.
Mm.
And Dr. John has a blog. Has Dr. Ron got a blog?
Dr. Ron uses the forum, essentially.
Lydia's been pestering Dr. Ron to post on the blog.
Lydia's been harassing me, yes.
Now, Lydia Davis, for those of you aren't familiar with, she's our Silicon Valley, Palo Alto correspondent in the heart of, where it all happens in the United States. From a technological point of view, she'll be joining us again tonight on the show too. Some very interesting stuff about viruses, because she's been to the RSA 2007 conference where, would you believe, a vast variety of people that have been talking, and none other than Colin Powell, the Minister for Defence or something, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
And he was at the conference as well, which was very interesting, but she has some very interesting news upon anti-Trojan software, which was a bit of an eye-opener for me too. They tested it, like on Vista and other sorts of things, and the results will surprise you, I'm sure.
I'm very good at looking forward to hearing from Lyd. I've also got a hello to Huggies, who's a long-time supporter of the program and
hello,
a forum contributor. G'day, Huggies.
Now, Huggies on my kid.
As you may or may not know, he says, YouTube has been rather buggy of late, and hence some people have left
What's
YouTube.
What's it been doing?
I don't know. I haven't looked at YouTube for a few weeks.
That's a Murdoch thing, YouTube.
It is.
He owns it now.
It
He's
is
got,
now.
As we said in the news tonight, great plans for that, and hopefully up the revenue stream. But there's all sorts of interesting gossip there, too, about people actually earning money by posting videos.
By posting videos on YouTube. Well, he says, look,
having
if you're
a share of the advertising cut, that's pretty impressive.
That's the one. He says if you're having problems with YouTube, there's an alternative service called livevideo.com. One channel of note is Faye006, which I find quite funny and would love it if you gave her a plug. Consider Faye006 plugged, Huggies. And another one that I've come across is juiced.com. That's another video sharing site, JOOST.com. There's a few of them out there starting to emerge.
Yeah, they're definitely springing up, aren't they? All over the place.
What are you seeing? Are you seeing anything decent? I must admit, I just don't have the time to hit YouTube and things like that.
It's YouTube-type flavoured stuff, Graeme, isn't it?
Yeah, mostly, yeah. It's
because Viacom had a go at YouTube the other day and made them pull all their stuff down. So you're seeing that type of material on
Well, that's one of the reasons that it's that they're spreading to other sites, because YouTube is starting to come over under a lot of scrutiny for copyright and so on.
Mm, yes. Well, we're going to talk digital rights management tonight too, speaking of copyright. Now, I know that's a really good pet hate of yours, Graeme.
Absolutely.
So, and of course, because Justin's in, we can have both sides of the fence, because we knew what happened. Remember the, we ran a segment last year on the program where we had Leo Laporte. I think you drew your attention to this one,
Dr.
Ron.
That's right. It was a short excerpt from one of his programs.
Speaking highly of
the Microsoft Zoom.
The Zoom product, which from all intents and purposes has just disappeared.
Well,
even in the US.
He gave it the canning it deserved, didn't he?
Well, he certainly did. And there's also news this week that the Zoom chief plans to leave Microsoft, which we'll be talking about a little bit later.
Yeah.
Says,
he's jumped ship, has he?
Yeah. Controversy
was he
aplenty.
A rat? Was he a rat off one of the sinking
Maybe.
Ones?
Maybe.
Oh, dear. Mm. Also,
you're suggesting Microsoft is sinking. That's
no,
a big
I'm
call.
Not suggesting anything like that. I'm just suggesting maybe that their Zoom was just... Yep.
Well, the Zoom has sunk, hasn't it?
It has. I haven't seen one, haven't heard about one or anything like that. So.
Let us know if you've got one. If you're listening on a Zoom right now, or you're going to buy one.
No, they wouldn't be able to, because the copy protection would have got them by now.
Yeah, it would have put copy protection on this program, which is distributed without copy protection, but let's not get started this early on in the show.
No. See what happens? I just mentioned DRM in the T's and we're off.
But send us an email if that's the case, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au.
And another cheerio to our new listeners listening to us on 4KZ, who are probably underwater at the moment, that part of Queensland. They had a lot of rain up there the other day, so much so that I heard on our news that good old far north Queensland had, in 1 week, had what Melbourne has in 2 years. That's pretty good, huh?
Mm, that's a bit scary.
It is. Another email from a supporter, I'd say, of this time is Rick from Stop and Go Radio in Chicago.
G'day, Rick.
We're heard in Chicago. He did send me some new transmission times. We're twice a week over there in Chicago.
Oh, that's very nice.
So
we're doing two shows a week.
No, we just repeat one. So. But Rick sent us an interesting thing about GPS sneakers allowing parents to track their children any place they go. Now, can you imagine GPS in your foot of your, I mean, in the tip of your shoe?
Well,
that's pretty amazing, really.
I'm trying to think of the logistics of that. They'd have to be able to be an antenna or something to see a number of GPS satellites. So it would have to have something at the top of each shoe, would it?
Like, well, an antenna? I don't know. We have to find out a little bit more about it. But in summary, this article is out of Miami. Isaac Daniel calls the tiny global positioning system chip he's embedded into a line of sneakers peace of mind. He wishes his 8-year-old son had been wearing them when he got a call from school in 2002 saying the boy was missing. The worried father hopped onto a flight to Atlanta from New York, where he'd been on business, to find the incident had been a miscommunication and his son was safe. Bugger. Days later, the engineer started working on a prototype of this new technology, which a line of $325 to $350 adult sneakers, which have little GPS systems built into them. Don't quite know how they work, but it's quite cute, really. It's like ones you can put on your dog to go and find your dog when your dog gets lost.
But there are two technologies involved in something like this, though, Andrew and Graham. You have to have the GPS receiver, which works out where you are, but then you also need a device which communicates that information.
Well, you need to monitor it
back somewhere.
I think the monitoring service is $20 a month, by the way.
There's this magnificent system around these days called mobile telephone networks, which you can send almost anything over these days.
So do you reckon there's a little mobile phone module inside the sneakers?
I'd say it's very likely. It's the most pervasive network that you could send that information back on, isn't it?
Mm. We'll have to have a bit of a look into it and see what happens. But thank you very much, Rick, for sending it across. They've been long-time supporters of us on Stop and Go Radio. One other thing this week which has really come to the forefront is weak passwords. Now, Graham, you're probably an advocate of password strength as opposed to weakness.
Absolutely.
A weak password is just that. It's a password which is like the family pet's name.
Yep.
Someone's name or something really silly like, you know, favorite football team. If someone knows of someone who barracks for a certain team, then that's what you call a weak password. Yep. Now, left online for 24 days to see hackers attack four Linux computers with weak passwords, they managed to get into, they had 270,000 intrusion attempts, about one every 39 seconds. And with weak passwords, they managed to get into a lot of systems very quickly. So amongst the key findings of this survey were weak passwords really do make hackers' jobs much easier. The study also found that improving selection of usernames associated with passwords can make a big difference in whether attackers can get into someone's computer. Because all they need to do is log on either through a terminal program or just you know, everything's online these days. Even email services like Gmail. Graham's probably a great testament to all this sort of stuff. You just want to think of a good username and a complex password.
Do you know a good way to make a complex password that's hard to guess?
Tell us.
It's instead of using a word or something that's familiar to you, like your football team or a name of somebody, something that would be in a dictionary, because what these bad guys use are lists of known words. One way is to, instead of using a word, use a whole phrase and then just pick the first letter of each word in the phrase. So if you could pick the phrase, I listen to Dr. Ron on Tech Talk Radio.
Oh, hang on a minute.
Oh, dear.
Number two. I'm going to get clever there.
Yeah.
Two.
D-R-R
on
T-T-R.
So IL2DROTTR is a good password.
That's right.
That's very good.
And that way you can make up a nice complex password that you can actually remember.
Don't anyone use that one, though. That's going to be mine now.
Okay.
Don't use my password.
Okay. Good. Now, good tip, Graham. That's a very good way of making up passwords.
Because I was going to suggest that it would follow that if it was difficult like that, it would also be difficult to remember. But it doesn't have to be difficult to remember, does it?
That's right. That's how you can make it easy to remember. And you can make it a phrase. You can have it, it can be a favourite family saying or something that someone outside your immediate circle isn't going to guess.
Good one.
Yeah, I've got a password sort of algorithm, for want of a better term, which, not unlike Graham's there, which I use as well. But I'm not going to tell you that, because if I told you, I'd have to shoot you. But internet banking, all your online email accounts, access to your computers, and all sorts of things like that can be jeopardized if somebody knows you communicate with them on a regular basis. And all they have to do is log on if they know your username, which on internet banking is probably tricky because an account number. But then again,
your account number is on checks. On your checks,
and it's on emails these days for direct debits.
Exactly.
All they need to do is log on to account BSB account number with the password, doggy, because that's your pet's name. And, look, they're in.
The other thing I hear a lot around the place is that people say, oh, it doesn't really matter if someone gets into my email. It's not that important. I don't really need a strong password. But what you don't realise is that by getting into your account, they get into the whole company's system, and you're jeopardising the security of the whole company, not just your email. Because getting that half a toe in the door server to get into even an ordinary user's account, that's a big step forward for someone who's trying to break in. So you've got to look at the big picture and not just think, oh, my email's not that critical.
Yeah, no, valid point. Now, in other news this week, Firefox is giving Explorer grief in this country, and I guess a few of you will be going, yeah. I must admit, I am a bit of a Firefox convert, but I found some idiosyncrasies with it, which I don't like. But since I found out how to edit them, it's pretty good. One of the traits of Firefox is the four consecutive downloads at one time, which can be edited in the config file, but you have to find it to work out how to do it.
Are you limited to four in the new version, eh?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes, you can only download... So if you're downloading large video files or whatever, you can only have four, six... What's the word? Synchronous downloads at the one time?
You can't, concurrent downloads, yeah.
Yeah, and then it just locks you out and says, no, you can't have any more. But there is a way of fixing it. But that's Firefox, but Internet Explorer. Now, you guys tinkered with IE a little bit?
Absolutely. I've got both Firefox 2 and Internet Explorer 7 on my computer, and I use them both at different times.
Well, so you have to.
I'm quite undecided as to which I prefer, and yeah, I'll happily use either. They've both got big advantages, and they've both got a couple of little annoying quirks.
Well, yeah, an example of not being compatible with each other, I just happen to be a Microsoft sales partner. You can't log into that on Firefox. It says go away.
No, and yeah, but that wouldn't be by design, would it, Mr.
No,
Microsoft?
No, exactly. And the other interesting thing, too, is if you're not a fan of Google in the map side of things, Google Earth, and you want to use Microsoft's live mapping stuff, you can't do some of the applications on that with Firefox either.
It's funny that Microsoft's own websites are some of the least compatible with Firefox. That's
amazing,
not a coincidence,
isn't
it?
Yes, yes. And another interesting thing too, which also in chatting with Lyd this week, and I won't steal their thunder, did you know that Google records all your searches for use later on in life?
Yes, I did.
Yep.
Good. We'll tell you how to fix that and more about that later on. I thought,
you can stop them from doing that, can you?
Yeah. So just out of curiosity, I didn't ask you, Dr. Ron, are you a Firefox guru or are you an IE guru? What's your preference?
My preference is certainly Firefox. And since I've been using Ubuntu, which is the alternate, the Linux-flavored PC operating system, there is no IE for Ubuntu or for Linux that I can find, so I've been using Firefox with great success, and also I use it on my PC as well.
Very good. Quick straw poll here in the studio. Everyone's here. What's your homepage set to when you log on, and what comes up first?
Oh, we've had this discussion before. I've got about eight tabs that open when I start my web browser.
Yes,
because I've got.
And what's the first one that appears on your screen then of your eight?
It would be my ISP's login page, so I can check my usage stats.
Boring, Graham.
Google News Science Technology page.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, mine's ABC local, so
good.
I can find out what's going on in the area.
Another good news source.
I haven't introduced Justin yet, but Justin, what's yours? He's sitting here in a microphone.
Not too surprisingly, it's mactalk.com.au.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, that was the voice of our special guest who will be on with us very shortly, so we'll be talking Mac. Now, one of the other things, guys, that I came across this week is there's a lot of podcasts starting to come into their own. Choice Magazine have started podcasting. Very interesting stuff.
Oh, that'll be an interesting one.
It is, and another person that started podcasting is the Domain Registrar here in Australia, the company which holds the database of all the .com.au domains.
Wow.
Now, they've got a very interesting podcast series about anything on the internet. And I sort of stumbled across it because I was doing some research before and thought, wow, this is pretty interesting. So have a visit to their website, which is www.auda.com.au.
Make sure you put those W's in as well. Don't do what I did and spend 5 minutes scratching your head just typing in auda.com.au. It doesn't work.
Yeah, that's funny the way that works, isn't it? Like most modern things, you don't need the W's these days, but no, the leading registrar here in Australia, you've got to add the W's.
They want that there for some reason.
Well, of course, that makes sense because their machines are likely to be doing other things than being web servers.
Like what?
Like domain name servers, perhaps?
Ah, there's the point. Yeah, they've got other things to do. Anyway, have a listen to this. This will give you a little bit of an indication about spam because, you know, we all love spam in this country, don't we? Not. Came across this, but feel free to go and have a visit their website and have a listen to some of these great little podcasts. When we return, that man's voice who you just heard before, Justin Dunlop, we're going to talk all about Macintosh.
Do, do, do. Jules, it's an unfortunate side effect of this wonderful thing called email that we need to talk about spam.
Oh, no, that stuff's horrible.
It is, and I don't know anyone who likes it.
It leaves a bad taste in your mouth.
Sure does. It's a scourge of the internet.
And I'd hate to know what they put in it. Scraps, I reckon.
Every day in my mailbox, it's full of the stuff.
Reminds me of school camps. Even if you fry it up on the campfire, it still tasted like spam. Except hot.
What? Oh, hang on. We're not talking about luncheon meat, you moron. We're talking about unwanted emails.
Oh. So what's the spam you're talking about?
Essentially, it's the practice of sending huge amounts of unsolicited commercial emails to internet users. Spam is mostly irrelevant and inappropriate. It's also known as junk mail or bulk email.
Oh, right, junk mail. Now I'm with you. I keep getting offers for cheap Viagra. At first that worried me because I definitely have the opposite problem. But apparently lots of people get the same email.
That light that just illuminated is my too much information light. Thank you very much. So, many people would have got this email, including myself, I might add. After you receive it once, you'll continue to get it again and again and again.
But how do they get our addresses? It must take ages to type them all into the to section of the email.
Spammers can easily buy 90 million email addresses on a single CD for about $20. They simply load these email addresses into their bulk email program and hit send. Mm. Most of the email addresses are duds and are of no use to the spammer at all. But enough do get through to a recipient. Spammers can also create a website which is designed specifically to grab your email address when you click on the site. You'll receive no warning when that happens.
Cheeky buggers.
And that's not all. They also prowl online forums, manually gathering email addresses, or use programs that automatically gather email addresses from newsgroups. It's like drift netting. No one approves, and eventually everyone falls into the net, much like the innocent dolphins and whales.
Maybe they could get an exemption so they could send a few hundred spam emails a year for scientific purposes. Man, they're busy beavers, these spammers.
They are. One other method is to take common domains like @yahoo.com and then generate email addresses using people's first and last names combined with other guesswork to create a working junk mail list.
Why do they do it? It's just bloody annoying everyone.
Well, Julian, a good spammer can earn around $100,000 a year, and they are paid per email sent. The more spam they send, the higher their income potential. On average, a million junk mails sent out will result in about 150 sales or leads.
Okay, so how much spam do they actually send?
A single spammer can send millions and millions of spam a day.
Bloody hell. Anything I can do about it?
Indeed there is, my little man. You can get yourself a spam blocker or filter. No program is 100% effective, but they're getting there.
Just out of interest, what does spam stand for?
Well, spam is not an acronym. It is, in fact, credited to Monty Python. Many years ago, Python performed a sketch which revolved around a small cafe and two customers asking, "What's on the menu?" The waiter launches into a huge sales pitch which involved everything on the menu having spam included. The word spam is mentioned 85 times in this one sketch, and that led internet users, many years later, to referring to repetitive, garbage email as spam.
Okay, so what are scams as opposed to spams?
Well, spam is annoying, unsolicited junk mail, as we've already said, whereas scams are both dangerous and illegal. They're designed to fraudulently separate you and your money, and email has become a great breeding ground for these illegal schemes.
So how do these schemes work?
Well, let's look at the email scamming Hall of Fame. The number one, the Darth Vader of fraudulent scams, is the Nigerian Advance Fee Scheme, also known as the 419 scheme.
That sounds bad. What is it?
Well, it's been around for years, and despite many warnings, it continues to draw in many victims. The US Financial Crimes Division still receives around 100 telephone calls a day about this scam. The Advance Fee Scam fraudulently obtains hundreds of millions of dollars every year.
All from email. Why do people fall for it?
Well, the email arrives, purporting to come from someone who works for a central bank or a senior civil servant within a government. They inform you that they're seeking a foreign bank account, i.e. yours. Mm. They want to deposit a large amount of money, millions usually, into your account.
Ooh.
They claim their government overpaid on a procurement contract. The goal of the scam is to delude the victim into thinking that they have been singled out to participate in a very lucrative, although questionable, arrangement.
And how do people actually fall for this?
Well, you'll be assured of the legitimacy of the arrangement with a variety of forged official documents. Once the victim appears confident of the success of the deal, there will be a series of fees demanded from them before the millions can be transferred into their account. Each fee is described as the very last fee required, and this tactic for extracting money can be stretched out over months.
So you can really lose your dough.
Sometimes more than that, victims can be requested to travel to the country to complete the transaction. They're told that a visa will not be necessary to enter the country. By bribing an official, the victim's illegal entry can be used by the scam artists to coerce the victim into releasing even more funds. Threats of physical harm may also be employed to further pressure victims. In 1995, an American was murdered in Nigeria while pursuing a 419 scam, and other foreigners have been reported as missing.
Right, that's it. I'm never going on the internet again.
No. Well, you don't need to do that. Just avoid the scams. Don't allow promises of large amounts of money to impair your good judgment. As British philosopher Francis Bacon said, money makes a good servant, but a bad master.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Joining the panel today on Tech Talk Radio is Justin Dunlop. For those of you who are new to Tech Talk Radio, Justin comes in and visits us from time to time. By invitation, though he tends to wants to gate crash, I hear, so he'll become the regular panellist. Good evening, Justin. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. And what's new? Probably a big question, that really, isn't it? What's new in the world of Mac at the moment?
Good evening, everyone. Well, back in the January 9th, there was the Macworld Festival, and his Steveness, the CEO of Apple Inc.
now. God.
No longer Apple Computer, by the way, Apple Inc.
That's right, they dropped the computer, didn't they, legally?
So,
I heard that.
Now they've released some new, or at least announced the release of some new products. I guess the most notable one's the iPhone, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment. The Apple TV, or iTV as it's been previously
known. That's my favourite, I think. I like that one.
Yeah, I thought so too. And they announced it back in September or thereabouts last year, and now they're announcing the shipping date for in Australia, about the 28th of February. It should arrive in people's houses for those that have ordered.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not convinced, but we can talk about that in a moment too.
Yep.
Along with that...
Why are you sceptical? What makes you sceptical about
the
whole...
Just the price point. I just go and buy a Mac Mini.
Yeah?
Rather than... And buy a full-fledged computer than a digital media box that doesn't have any smart... Well, a lot of smarts. But we'll talk about that if we get a chance.
Yep.
AirPort Extreme is a product that's been around for a while, but they've upgraded it to the yet-to-be-ratified 802.11n specification. So it's basically faster.
11N. I've just caught up with B's and G's, let alone N's.
So this
108 megabits per second on wireless.
Is that what the N is?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
So this beast is meant to be about 5 times faster than the former standard, but yet to be ratified. Even so, people are releasing it. And there's rumours abounding that the new Mac operating system 10, codenamed Leopard, will be released either on March the 28th or perhaps as early as February 20.
Is this 10.5?
Yes, it is.
Why do you think he didn't mention it in the keynote?
It's interesting. We expected, sorry, when I say we, the Mac community, I think, expected to hear about Leopard because it's been in the pipeline and there's been sneak previews for the past 6 months or thereabouts. And we kind of expected a few Macintosh products to be launched at Macworld, but in fact, no Mac products were. The iPhone and the Apple TV were the only things he really talked about.
One of the other launches, which my ears pricked up, when he announced it on January the 9th, was that the iTunes store now has over 2 billion songs in it. That's pretty impressive when you think about it.
It's amazing, and depending whose statistics you look at, I think we talked about this last time I was in, it's about 70% of the market, they say, of online media is sold through iTunes. The interesting thing when we start talking about the Apple TV product is that the main reason you'd buy it is so that you could stream live video programs and TV programs from the iTunes Music Store. Catch for us in Australia, they don't have any video content.
Fundamental issue in marketing, I would say there.
Possibly.
So, yes, and talking about DRM, as we touched on earlier, which is digital rights management, we've got all these new gadgets, the new iPhone, which is the MP3 player and all that built in at one. Are there any changes? Because Steve Jobs, the CEO, or the boss cocky over there at Apple Inc., has recently in the media tried to get the record companies, which 90% of record company content goes out unprotected, that is on a CD. But when it comes to buying music on iTunes or online shops, they're all protected. He's trying to get that last remaining 10% of audio unprotected. Any ideas why he's trying to do this? Is it?
I suspect it's so that he can increase the market share for the iTunes Music Store. I mean, as I understand it, his statement basically had three points in it. One was that if you continue with DRM the way it is, and I'm sure you guys have spoken about this before, but if you continue with DRM the way it is, then you'll be splitting up the music market to, you know, some very large monopolies, but you won't be able to go to one store to get everything because EMI will be with a different label, Sony with someone else. He said that the other solution is to use the Apple Fair Play product, which is the Apple DRM as the standard, but he said if he licensed that, he'd be a fool, and he is, he would be. So the third option is...
Just have no DRM.
No DRM, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess Steve and some of the commentators on the web talking about it reflect on the fact that Apple and the iPod in particular get a bit of bad press because of the DRM restrictions that it's got on it. But in fact...
But they're imposed by the record companies as opposed to the manufacturers, isn't it?
Well, it's a bit of both. I think Apple implement it in order to win the contract to have the product online. So I think it's a bit of both. One's prepared to do it in order to get the business, which probably makes them as guilty or as innocent as the other. But there are great pains at the moment, I noticed, to say that iTunes and the iPod was always designed to be DRM-free, but they had to implement it in order to gain the commercial advantage.
Mm. If you look at what Microsoft's done, Justin, they've sort of gone in hammer and tong full steam ahead with DRM, almost to the point where... Well, they
made
have
it
gone,
unusable, well, haven't they?
They have made it unusable, and they've also taken the step that they're actually paying a percentage of each Zoom sale back to the record companies.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the commentators from the Australian Mac area is saying that if Apple sort of gets the whirlwind behind them for anti-DRM,
yeah,
that one of the products that they could actually offer to small upcoming bands is you upload your music to the music store and Apple sell it for you, cut out the record label in the middle. And so, you know, 80%, 90% goes back to the actual musician.
To the artist. So
and 10% at Apple.
They'll become their own record label eventually.
Without needing to make any records.
I heard an interview on radio locally here recently where we had some musos, the people you just described, talking about online selling of music. And the underlying message that I got from the interview was the fact that if you sold your music through a record company, you could like track where it's gone. You can knew that you sold X number of CDs, X number of discs into whichever record store. But the whole upshot of this online world is that it's an honor system. No one knows how many sort of tracks are actually sold unless you are the proprietor of that music distribution chain, that online site. So from a muso's point of view, these guys were saying that they weren't that fond of all the online things. It was like just giving your music off into a void and you didn't know who ended up listening to it.
I suspect that's sticking your head in the sand a bit, because if people are going to share music, they'll share it off a CD or off online. I don't think it'll make
any
difference.
I'm sure they will. It's not so much about the sharing. It's from a muso's point of view about where their target market is for their music.
Yeah, if they make a CD and sell CDs, they know how many they've sold because they know how many they've had printed.
Yeah, and they know which record shop they've sold it through, so they can work out demographics of their music and who's buying it. But on the internet, I don't think they get that information back.
Hmm, interesting.
There's a lot of
these musos. Did they arrive driving Porsches and Lamborghinis and with,
I wasn't there. I wasn't privy to that information. Right.
I'm betting they didn't. They're not.
No, musos, as we all know, working in the industry, basically the most of them would probably eat sort of like, you know, wage check to mouth, so to speak, as opposed to having life savings and beach houses and certain salubrious established areas around town. So it was just an interesting thing. The other thing, Steve Jobs came out and said, he seems to be of the one of the great benefits of DRMing, or removing all the digital rights management.
DRMing.
Oh, that's confusing.
is that the music can be played on anything. Like you can download from iPod shop, from the music store, and play it on anything.
Mm,
yeah. And that was probably the selling point, I think, from Steve. That's what I got out of it. I don't know if you guys did it as well, but just to be able to, anyone can download from iTunes, anyone can download from iZune or whatever they have, or any of the other online music shops that we have here in Australia, and play it on any device.
Yeah,
I think that's got to be good.
Absolutely. That's the biggest problem, is that you download it in one format and you can only play it on that device. You download it from the Apple Store and you can only play it on your iPod and nothing else.
How many people do you think when they go into a shop and buy their iPod realise that?
Not very many.
Do you reckon they'd be annoyed? I could think of another word, but do you think they'd be annoyed when they get home and they say, right, I want to get some music on my iPod. I go to iTunes, I can download. That's it. That's the only place I can buy from.
I think more would be annoyed if they understood more of what goes on. I think a lot of people sort of use the technology to such a limited basis that, they don't get quite so far as running into the problems. And I think if people realised that they don't download it from iTunes to play on their thing and buy a CD, I should be able to download it from iTunes and play it on my CD player without having to, jump through hoops to get it there.
You're making a very large...
And people don't realise that that's a restriction that's on there.
It's a large investment that you're making as well. If you're downloading all of your music for the last 5 or 6 years of your life and it's all going onto your iPod, and then you decide, well, I'm going to try out this new SanDisk now. My iPod's getting a bit old, long in the tooth. It's getting a bit bashed and battered and pushed around. I must be able to transfer my whole library over to my new SanDisk machine or my new Zune or my new JNC media player or whatever it is that I've bought.
Let alone if you accidentally drop your iPod in the drink or something and you lose all the content off it.
That's right, Graham. You might have hundreds if not thousands of dollars worth
of songs.
You
can't re-get it.
No,
you can't re-download
it. It's gone.
Can I just change the subject briefly and we'll move on from this? New York, lovely part of the world for those of you who have been there. New Yorkers who blithely cross the street listening to an iPod or talking on their mobile phone could soon face a $100 fine.
Oh, I read this. This is just this.
I haven't heard. This should be an odd spot. Now, keep going.
Do you reckon this is fair go? Like you're sitting there. Like, I've seen this before. I've experienced it. I think I might have been talking to you on the phone at the time, Dr. Ron.
Pod rage.
A woman walked across in front of me. She was on her mobile phone. She was texting on her mobile phone.
Yeah.
And the traffic was going relatively slowly.
That's right. Because you nearly drove over the top of her.
And she just didn't look. She just walked straight out into the street. Now, this is obviously a problem in New York. What do you think? $100 fine?
You'd have to do it in front of a police car, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, but normally there's an officer on corners of streets. You see someone... I think it's taking the penalty system a little bit to the nth degree, but
this is
only
New York,
maybe.
Yeah.
And it's going against Darwin's theory, of course. You'd want to get rid of those people, wouldn't you?
Well, there's the point, exactly. Yeah. Darwinism, yes.
Do you get little warnings on stickers, JD, when you buy your, your iPod? They'll be next, won't it?
iPod might be dangerous.
It's be like on the cigarette packets. They'll have people implanted on hoods of bonnets.
Yes, New York customers not to be used when crossing a busy road. Not to be used as protection from a hurricane and what else?
Those sorts of dangerous for your health.
Now, whilst on the subject of humour... we've all seen the Apple ads, haven't we?
We have.
Oh, yes.
There's a new one out for Vista, the Vista upgrade. Now, I would like to talk to Justin about this in just a sec. But for those of you who aren't familiar with the ads, here's the Vista one.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
Are you going in for a checkup?
Well, I'm upgrading to Vista today, which is great, but I get a little nervous when they mess around with my insides.
Well, what do you mean? Isn't it just straightforward?
Not really. Like a lot of PCs, I have to update my graphics card, my memory. If I want the premium package, I need a faster processor. It's major surgery.
I'm sorry about that.
Listen, Mac, if I don't come back, I want you to have my peripherals.
Oh, come on. PC, you're not good. Speaking of peripherals...
Yeah, speaking of peripherals...
Poor old PC in his hospital gown. It's letting it a bit too much show, is it?
There's a lot of those great ads up there. Justin, running Vista, can you run Vista on the new... on the Mac,
been for some time, I understand. And I think we, again, had this discussion before. There's a couple of different technologies available to do that.
Yep.
One actually ships with as a beta product, a testing product with the current Mac operating system. It's called Boot Camp, and allows you to choose when you start your computer whether you run Windows or whether you run the Mac operating system.
So not so much Windows XP, but Windows XP or Vista.
Well, it's designed for XP, but my understanding is, not having done it myself, that you can run Vista if you've got an advanced copy or now a legal copy.
I wonder if you can run the high-res GUI with all the hardware issues. Graham, do you know? Because you can
I don't know, but yeah, Vista's just really an upgraded Windows XP, so there's no reason why the requirements would be that different. But I it would depend on the drive availability and the quality of the graphics card. And I'd imagine the Macs would have fairly good graphics cards in them.
They usually do. My understanding is that, and again, haven't played with it, but I understand Vista works very well out of the box using Boot Camp. But if you're trying to use emulation...
What emulation?
Where you're running their Mac operating system, and then you decide that you want to run Windows on top of it in a separate window, and there's a product called Parallels, and I think there's VMware out now with a product. They've not had such great reliability with graphics, but I understand the new version of Parallels does, so gamers apparently are very happy about that.
Oh, I can imagine. Steve Jobs came out earlier this week, February the 6th to be precise, and said Apple's has warned Windows iTunes users not to rush to upgrade to the Vista operating system, saying compatibility issues could prevent iTunes from working correctly. Have you heard any gossip along this line?
No, I haven't. What I have seen is that there was a fix released not so long ago, in the last 14 days or so, and I was wondering what that was all about. Now I know.
Yes.
The last great iTunes debacle of 2006.
And it's about to be a new one.
A new debacle.
Yeah, well, those people that have had a bit of a play with the Apple TV have recognised, in fact, if you look at the website, it says that you need iTunes 7.1, which hasn't actually been released yet.
No, what are they up to? 7.0 something or other. Well, that's a bit of a Freudian whoops-a-daisy. That'd be embarrassing.
It's not unusual when a new operating system comes out that a lot of programs will need to release minor updates to deal with its quirks. So that's not so unusual that iTunes was caught amongst that.
All right, when we come back, we're going to take a little break. We're going to have a little chat to Lyd in the United States. She talks a bit about Mac too. Cool. Justin will stay with us. So stay tuned to us on Tech Talk Radio. We'll be back with more after this.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week, you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever, and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
visiting the relatives, washing the car.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Any of you guys managed to ever visit the heart of Silicon Valley in the US?
I haven't been to the US. I'd love to one day, but not yet.
I must have a chat to Lyd one day about what it's like over there from a technological point of view, like the local Radio Shack.
You've been to the US?
Yes, I have, on a couple of occasions. I haven't been to actually Silicon Valley. I've been to San Francisco and I've been down to LA, but I haven't actually got out through Oakwood and head down south. Like even Tim Westergren, who we spoke to last week, he's a Palo Altarian, I think, from want of a better term, if that's who they are.
Palo Altarian, that's probably correct. Yeah.
Hey, one of the interesting things that I read across the course of summer, because you just tend to read books. Justin, have you read Steve Wozniak's account of the Apple days?
No, I haven't. I've read a couple of blogs about it, but I haven't actually read the book yet.
I couldn't put it down.
Yeah?
It was fantastic. This man was evil. When I mean that, when I mean evil, I mean from a practical joke point of view. He was one of the... He would have been my idol when I was at school, let me tell you. The things he did with remote controls and electronics and technological sort of gizmos, it was just amazing. But very interesting person who's now no longer really part of the Apple family as such. Is that right?
He's still associated, but yeah, he's certainly not an advocate anymore.
He was amazing. His philosophy in life was to get as many small... how would you sort of say? The technology on the boards, the computer chips, his idea was to get as much functionality and as much power out of as few components as possible.
Mm.
Not bad. And to find out, the thing which blew me out of the water was the Apple II, which really put people... You've got one of these, haven't you, Justin?
Several.
The Apple II, several. Do they all work?
They do.
Oh, sensational. Mm. The Apple II was originally offered to Hewlett-Packard. Did you guys know that? And Steve...
He used to work for
Steve
them.
Was. Yeah, he started life working for Hewlett-Packard. Do you think Hewlett-Packard's life would have been changed if they actually took him up on his offer to actually build we now know as the Apple II?
Quite possibly. If you said it was someone else, if it was Intel or someone else, you'd say no because they wouldn't market it appropriately. But HP possibly would have because they've got some really good management structures and tend to listen to their people. Not on this occasion, for some reason. But,
No, back then they were building... Do you remember the old scientific calculator? I think when we were back at school they came out, the old HP financial calculators and... Things like that.
Yeah, HP had programmable calculators you could, play games on and all sorts of things.
So. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, that was just my holiday reading. I thought I'd digress there for a moment. Lydia Davis, Palo Alto, here's her report for this week. She's been to the RSA conference, which concluded yesterday. She's very tired, actually. She spent all day there and for the last 5 or 6 days. So, she's a bit tired. But nonetheless, we got some very interesting gossip from her. You you're obviously Colin Powell's new best friend, so tell us about the RSA conference and what you discovered there.
It was really interesting. There's been a lot of talk about internet and, well, the security, obviously. There's several things that need addressing, and if we don't address them, we're in huge trouble. Phishing is a problem. Mobile phone hacking is a problem. You know, there were certain things that they kept saying, and not just one. Everyone was saying the same thing, whether it was Symantec, McAfee, Microsoft, Kaspersky. All of them were saying we really need to look at having different levels of security. And that's not just passwords. Passwords are no good. They're talking about, you know, you need not only passwords, you need biometrics, you need smart cards, you need layers and layers and layers of security if you wish to stay safe in this, what they're calling the information revolution.
Now, you had a chat to Mr. Kaspersky the other day. Now, he's the Russian antivirus, anti-spyware author and has a fairly interesting website. How did you come to meet him?
He's amazing. I actually sat in on a session that he held, and it was quite cute. It was called The Dark Side of Cybercrime, and he was really great. I mean, he was very simple.
Could you understand him? How was his Russian?
Absolutely. He's got the wickedest accent, let me tell you. It's wonderful to listen to. But he was talking about how viruses have mutated, I suppose, over the years and how the first... Now, I've got to tell you this. He taught me something. I didn't know this. The first virus written for computers was written for an Apple Mac.
Ah.
Did you know?
No, I didn't.
Did you know that?
No,
neither did
that.
I. And I thought it was wickedly ironic, really. Some university student here in the United States.
Was this back in the Apple II days, that far back, or was it more recent times?
Apple I, II, no, it was a long time ago. It was the first virus known, well, supposedly known, and it was a hidden Apple.
How ironic, sir.
Intended for an Apple. Isn't it ironic? I think it's wonderful. But he was brilliant because he talked about a lot of stuff, and he walked through where things happened, how things happened, and where things are going. And one of the things what he actually left on, and I love, was he said, "I'm waiting for Internet Interpol." And I thought, isn't that brilliant? Because that's exactly what we need. We need not only physical, but some sort of, you know, Internet policing. Not someone going in there and raiding your house, but we need someone following this and really being aware of what's going on in this sort of world, in the security world, because there's so many different things coming out so quickly that people aren't keeping up with them. And you look at, let's look at Vista, for example. That was released not long ago. Now, what happened was when Vista was launched, there's a company called Virus Bulletin. Have you heard of them?
No.
They're an organisation that basically sit there and look at products that come out and then throw viruses at them and then use different types of antivirus software to see whether they're working or not. And what they did with Vista, they tested, I think it was 15 security suites. I think they tested like 15 various antivirus companies on these wild lists.
So like the Symantecs database and the McAfees and all that sort of stuff. They just compared. Yeah. And what were the results?
Kaspersky got 100% rating. Now, what's impressive about that is they gave them a product, which is the Kaspersky Antivirus 6, version 6, I think it was. And it was running a beta version of the maintenance pack. And that passed at 100%. So they got the award for that, saying, okay, this company will get, you know, all bugs that we
stop everything that comes at it.
Absolutely. Guess who failed?
Microsoft?
Absolutely. OneCare. Microsoft OneCare. Would you believe it?
So Microsoft actually have an antivirus thing? Have they got an antivirus program, or is this through their Defender software, which I thought was more a Trojan thing rather than a virus thing and a, you know, backdoor thing?
As far as I know, there's a product called OneCare, and it seems to sort of cover a whole lot of their products, and it's supposed to look at malware and virus stuff and all sorts of things, you know, including Trojans and that. Now, an interesting thing that the head of Symantec, John Thompson, said at the conference, he had a keynote almost immediately after Billy. He made this comparison, and people were taking it out of proportion, but really what he was saying was you wouldn't trust your accountant to do your auditing, so why would you want the person that supplies your operating system to do your antivirus stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everyone laughed at that, and it was all a big joke, but really, at the end of the day, it's true. There's a huge conflict of interest, and if Microsoft is producing operating systems, they should be focusing on that. And sometimes I wonder, as much as I love Billy, you know, I sometimes wonder whether they're spreading themselves too thin and doing so much stuff that they're not really doing anything well anymore.
Yeah, maybe it's time to specialise in the, you know, operating systems or whatever. So what was Colin Powell doing there? What was he talking about?
He was talking about just different things, but at the end of the day, he was saying what it's about. To him, what I thought was quite interesting, he was saying, well, we really need to focus on security, and that's what he's been doing, but he's been doing it in a military sort of sense rather than electronic. And now that he's retired, he's coming up to 70, he was just saying that these all these experiences he's had over his lifetime, it was pretty impressive. He had a standing ovation. He walked in and everyone was just up and applauding, and as he left, the same thing happened. But he was more talking about leadership and things that you need to do as a leader and drawing comparisons to that.
Well, you spent a lot of time up at the RSA 2007 concert. What was the highlight for you?
Eugene Kaspersky.
Yeah?
I can't get over it. It's a little company, supposedly, because have you heard of Kaspersky Lab?
Oh, yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Well, as far as I know here, you know, you've got Symantec, you've got McAfee, and they're the people that they're the companies that people turn to here for security. And I look at Symantec, and I love, you know, all their products. I always love Norton, always have, you know that. Kaspersky's product is very different, and the way they work is instead of doing it once a day, once a week, whatever it is that other companies do, is they do it every hour. So the first sweep, when they go through your computer and they go through everything, and they say, okay, this is what we've got, and these are the problems you've got, these are good things. From there on in, every hour it will check your PC and say, okay, these are the files that have changed. And within the files that have changed, you've either got really good things or really bad things. So if you've got something bad in the files that have changed since the last sweep, it'll basically quarantine it. So it puts it aside and says, okay, we need to look at this. And, you know, with Symantec, like, I don't know whether I told you, but I tried sending you an email a couple of days ago. It couldn't be sent for like four or five times. Norton said, not sending it. Just not sending it. And I'm thinking, you know, for me to change this, I've got to go through all these settings and muck around with my PC, and I don't have the time for it because I was out the door. And that bugs me, and I'm thinking, why can it not be easy where I just press a button and say, okay, I know that that's what I'm sending is safe. It's not spam. I'm not sending you spam. I'm sending you a picture, you know, and that was what it was. I think the problem was Norton saying, well, hang on, it's too big a picture. There's no text in there. I tried to type a bit of text in there, but I just couldn't be bothered playing with it for, you know, half an hour.
All got too hard.
Yeah, it did. And this is where Kaspersky says, no, well, we won't do that. We'll put in an area for you, and then you decide, do you want it or not? Do you want to send it? Do you want, you know? And I like that. So the prices are comparable. I don't know. I haven't actually tested the product. I haven't played with the product, sadly. I'd like to have done it by now, but I haven't had the chance. But from what I hear and from all the reports I've read about them, they've done really well. And they should be better known and they should be better used, I think, you know, personally, because I've gone from McAfee to Symantec, and this is just personally, you know, personal opinion. I've gone from McAfee, which was just a disaster. Then I've moved on to Symantec, and who, like I said, who I love, Norton, everything's wonderful, but it's just clogging my machine. So now I want to try Kaspersky's, and I suspect from what I've read, it should be a good thing.
All right, so he obviously impressed you at the conference. Well, that's...
Absolutely.
That's good. So you can load your stuff up and tell us how you go, because I'll probably give it a go too, especially if it's the same price. He's got a good website too, having a look on the site.
He's got lots of information there. I mean, they update it, you know, all the time. So you can see, if you have a look at his site, which is kaspersky.com, I should probably spell that, K-A-S-P-E-R-S-K-Y.
.com. Very good. We probably should move on to Google and have a quick chat about Google's Big Brother scenario, keeping an eye on our history and what's going on.
As you know, Google's been hitting Australia a lot. You know that, I take it.
Because we're aware of the flyover.
Yeah, you've had the flyover. They're also, there's a search conference happening in the next couple of months in Australia in Sydney, and they're like the major sponsors. So they're getting in there and they're sending all their guys over there to talk about search optimization and how to do these things well. And I'm suspecting it's because you guys are still, I think they're falling behind Microsoft by like 3% in terms of ratings. Very little. That's very little. It's not huge with home users, where people go to MSN instead of going to Google, and they want to fix that. I mean, but the coolest thing I thought was, they did the flyover of Sydney, as you know, and people were spamming it, you know, absolutely. Well, they were saying we're spamming, but it's not really, because Google invited the spamming, so they did it. Well, let me tell you something. Sydney Morning Herald, there's a guy called Stephen Hutchin there that decided to do a little test. So he said, okay, let's see how you go going from the Sherburn Hotel to Google's headquarters in Sydney through Google Maps.
Yeah.
Sherburn Hotel, I think, I don't know whether I'm pronouncing it correctly, but 200 Sussex Street. Google Sydney headquarters, across the road, 201 Sussex Street.
Yeah.
Should have been a walk across the road.
Yeah, so how did they tell them to get there?
18 minutes across the bridge and back. Do you love it? Sorry.
Well done, Google. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was the cutest thing. Google have been keeping a record of every search that you do, okay? So they associate your search history and with your Google login for whether it's Gmail, Calendar, whatever it is.
That's why I sign out.
Now, this is really cool for some people, but most people don't even know that this is actually happening. So most people don't realise that they're getting all their details logged of where they go and all this sort of stuff. Now, you wonder about that because, you know, with AdWords and stuff, you start wondering why they're doing that. But at the same time, there is a way of turning it off. There's a settings page. There's a search history recording in the settings page of your account in Google.
Okay, I'm going to my account now. I'll see if I can find it. Search history, there we go. Yes, you're right. My services.
You should have a settings page where you can edit your history and you can also remove it completely.
Oh, so they want my password again.
This is the thing that they've been doing for some time. People don't know about it. You know, I think it's like 99% of Google users would have no clue that this is happening. So,
oh, look, there's all my search history that I've typed into Google. How about that? Well, one of the times that I've been logged in anyway. All right, Lyd, it's been fantastic once again. Thank you very much and we'll talk again soon.
I thought it very funny that the Google experience just directly across the road from the hotel took them across the Harbour Bridge and back. It's pretty good, huh?
Top Gear, which is a British motoring show, had a few examples of this with the satellite navigation, in-car satellite navigation.
Oh, really?
Choosing extraordinary routes from one place to another. They had between two towns in the south of England they chose, and it sent them via Ireland and France to get there. It was... There's a few examples of extraordinary results with these maps.
But can't you tell such systems that you want to either travel via the most direct route or the quickest route, which might not be the most direct?
Well, that's sometimes where the confusion arises, and you can tell it to avoid tolls or to not use certain roads, and you can get some extraordinary results out of the things.
Sometimes if you're getting dynamic traffic information as well, the system might figure that into the equation and say, well, this road is congested at the moment, or this road works in this street, so you have to go this way.
We should do a program on...
But excuse for not being able to cross the road. Sorry, Andrew.
Came first, the chicken or the egg. We should actually do a program on satellite navigation, because there's... I was reading through the Choice magazine issues. They're not all what they seem, let me tell you.
That'd be good. If you've got any experience with using the satellite navigation equipment, write in and tell us about it, or post up on the forum.
And they're in all the cars.
Forum.techtalkradio.com.au.
Like, I drive a four-wheel drive. I don't have one, but when I'm driving home on the freeway, there's little things glowing on everyone.
Oh, you see it everywhere, don't you? Yeah.
So they're obviously fairly, you know, as we go in this country, we're pretty tech-savvy. We like jumping on these things.
Absolutely.
And using them. Back to the iPhone. I remember on the morning after it had been launched, a colleague of mine who is such a Mac, he's got it imprinted on the forehead of his thing. He came in. Did you see my new phone last night? And I'm going, no. Oh, I suppose I better log on and have a look. But the iPhone was quite an interesting concept in respect to the fact that, as Steve Jobs went on, he said that it was three things. I can't remember the exact words he was, but he went on and on infinitum about it. Justin, what are your thoughts on the new device? Do you reckon it's a real... Is it really what it's all hyped up to be?
Well, I'd have to say yes. But I've been waiting for this product for a while. There's been some rumours about it floating around for probably the best of 5 years.
And, that long?
Absolutely. And the Apple Newton, for those that have been around the Apple industry for a while, people will realise claims to have started the personal digital assistant revolution, so the Palm Top revolution.
Oh, I remember the Newtons that they have been around. That was a long time ago,
wasn't
it?
Back in the 90s. And the last reincarnation of that, which was, I think, the Message Pad 2100, had really nice handwriting recognition. It had some smarts in it that haven't really been replicated, that you could write into it and have lunch with Andrew, and it would know that I always have lunch at 12 from past history. It would know which Andrew I talk to most often and would actually put it straight into my calendar. Now, the iPhone won't do that, as far as I'm aware, but that's the type of technology Apple's had in the past. So it's kind of interesting to look at this. Steve actually, I think, announced at Macworld that he was revealing three new products, but in fact all three were the iPhone.
Yeah, it's a play on words.
Yeah. Mm. So
I remember the image of the iPod on screen with the Maxwell Smart old phone number thing that he put up on the keynote.
So, right. You know, it's a widescreen iPod, video iPod. It's a phone and a wireless internet navigator is the three products that they're selling it for.
So with wireless, it is actually Bluetooth as well as Wi-Fi?
It's certainly Justin? Wi-Fi. Yeah. I'm not sure about Bluetooth. It's not in the specs, but then again, not a lot of the specs are out just yet because it's not actually released.
That's going to be my next question. Can you even buy it in the States yet? Because they had them all underneath Perspex cabinets. And
yeah, no, June 2007 is when it's being released, okay. in the States only.
Mm-hmm.
It won't hit our shores, they think, until 2008.
Until a 3G version comes out, because our 2.5G
quite possibly
gets shut down in January, if Mark were here.
Mm, so they're actually, Apple is talking, or Apple Inc., Justin, is talking about a 3G version, aren't they?
They were. There's some interesting rumours flying about, particularly in the Australian Mac forums. With the iPhone coming out in June, the US price is around $500 for the smaller model, a couple of hundred more for the bigger model.
That's the four gig, is that right?
Four gig's the small one, eight gig's the big one.
Yep.
But you have to get a contract with Singular, so it's a contracted phone.
That's one thing I did notice, that they are on Singular, which is a network in America that's very similar to Telstra's Next G network here.
It gets even more interesting than that, because they've got GPRS Edge system that Telstra currently run.
Yep.
The rumour sites say that Rogers Wireless will be the Canadian carrier. Very similar network. In fact, I'm led to believe, it's a shame we haven't got our colleague here today, but I'm led to believe Singular, Rogers and Telstra are almost identical networks in their infrastructure.
Really? Well, there you go.
And their planning. So
that gives you a clue as to what might be in the future.
Quite possibly. And Gary Barker in The Age recently wrote an article about Telstra testing and trialing the iPhone as well.
Oh, cool.
And neither Apple nor Telstra would comment, which would sort of suggest
we must have a word with Mark and see if he's heard any rumours.
Yeah, Mark, have you seen one? I bet you haven't.
Now, with the iPhone, apparently it's got a really interesting user interface with your hand gestures and two fingers on the phone at the same time. And
yeah, it is interesting. I remember watching some TV shows talking about multi-touch technology within the last 12 months, and they were being run by supercomputers. So it's kind of interesting that the iPhone's going to have multi-touch, and I'm quoting that for those who can't see the studio. The multi-touch in this case, at least in the demonstrations, suggests you can put two fingers on the screen and squeeze an image to make it smaller, or stretch an image to make it bigger. Whether that means you can put more than two fingers on the screen, I don't know. And that's really perhaps what the supercomputer can
do. But we haven't seen that before in PDAs, have we? Usually you have one point where you can either touch the screen with your finger or with a stylus.
That's right.
And that's all it can deal with.
A couple of issues. Styluses won't work on these. It needs a bio contact, so it needs to be a person's finger or appendage.
But that was what Steve was saying. Everyone's got a pointing device. Let's use it.
Mm.
I thought it was a pretty valid argument, really, wasn't it?
It requires bare skin to operate. So, you said, Justin, you can't tap it with the back of a pen.
No,
or
I can't
like
tap
that.
It with a pen, which I guess is good for accidental turn-ons and offs and dials and so forth.
Mm.
They've got some interesting technologies in it. They've got a proximity detector. Don't ask me what that does, whether it measures the temperature or whatever.
No, it measures
it
whether it's close to your face.
Yeah.
And then if you put it up to your face, it turns off all the buttons so you can't accidentally
that's right.
Change channel or dial someone that you don't want to by
hitting it with your earlobe.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. Which is reasonably smart, because I use the iMate O2, you know, beastie, and I do that all the time on that phone.
One of the things I liked about it, you could rotate it, and it knew it had been rotated, so you could go portrait or landscape just by turning the device.
It's got an accelerometer in it to do that.
Very exciting for watching movies on a little small device. Sorry,
absolutely.
Go on. Yes.
And it's got a couple of other interesting things. I guess the buzz is that, you know, it's the Newton replacement. It's the product to rival Windows Mobile and those various products. Two downsides. One of them is actually a positive. It's running the new version Mac OS 10.5.
I thought that was a positive. I really did, having a fully fledged operating system behind
a device
positive. Like this.
The buzz, though, is that it'll be locked down so heavily that you won't be able to program for it. So unless you've actually been specifically licensed,
you could be authorized to actually write code for the damn little sucker.
And that was the nice thing about the Newton and some of the other PDAs that have been around, is that the Newtons still sell today because you can buy a new product for
it. So when you say lockdown, will it run an application that you could normally run on a Mac, or it has to be validated or authorized to run on an iPhone? Is that what they're so saying by locking it down?
Yeah, I think it needs to be validated, and that's not inconsistent with Apple's history. They've always said for the Mac you need to match their use and feel, look and feel and so forth. And they've certainly adopted a slightly different user interface for this. Whilst it's Mac OS X, there's no Finder, so there's no browser to look within the machine. It's got a slightly different concept of operations, I guess, in terms of what you see on the screen. It's got one button, so I guess it's like the one mouse button, but it's got one button, which is the home button, which presumably turns it on, but probably gets you back to the home page as well. But the everything else is done on screen. So you roll your finger along the screen to scroll the page, for example. As we mentioned, you pinch or expand your fingers to zoom or maximize.
Steve was flicking it, like flicking with his finger as he flicks in the studio across the top of the actual screen. It's well worth having a look. Apple.com, and you can click down the bottom left, I think it is. It says Keynote or something with Steve. Go and have a look. If you want to spend 2 hours and you've got good bandwidth,
So they are pretty entertaining, those presentations. It's worth a look, yeah.
Yeah, he's reasonably charismatic with his presentations. Just so the one bad issue was the lockdown. The second bad issue before we cut out is the battery is going to be sealed, non-replaceable.
Oh, so when your battery's carked, that's it. Unit's gone. See ya.
So for professional use, people will take multiple batteries so they can keep talking for 2 days on end. Not a possibility.
That is a bit of a... Why is that? Is it because they don't want you opening up the back of it or something like that? They build them with them in and stuff? That's
certainly in terms of size. What the arguments that have sort of been discussed online is size, that in order to have a compartment that can open and you can replace the battery, it makes the thing bigger. But to be honest, if you're designing a professional device, I think you'd have to think about replacement batteries, particularly with the history of the iPod and their sealed batteries.
Mm. I've got another downside.
Quick.
Direct downloading of files from the iTunes store. Bubbo. Yes.
What?
Why is that bad?
It's not supported.
Oh, okay. So you have to download it to your Mac and then across to the device.
Isn't that how it works now with an iPod? You can't. You got to download it into iTunes, and iTunes pushes it across.
Doesn't have Wi-Fi though.
Oh.
This device has got Wi-Fi, so you think if you're actually on the network,
and it's got a web browser in it.
Exactly.
It says it.
It's got some Safari in it.
OS X comes with Safari.
We're going to take a break, guys. When we come back, we'll wrap up and talk about the future of Mac, and where we put all these three things together, and let's see what comes out of the wash.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
If you want the latest Tech Talk Radio on your smartphone or PDA, visit the new Tech Talk Radio website, ttr.mobi. This is a lightweight website designed especially for small screen devices, so it loads quickly and provides easy navigation around our most popular links. You can find out what's on the current program, check show archives, and access links to the regular website. Remember, for the latest Tech Talk updates when you're on the move, go to ttr.mobi.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to the panel. Our guest is Justin Dunlop, and we're talking Macintosh and all things Mac. Now, before we went to the break there, we were talking about the pros and cons of the new iPhone device, which was launched in January of this year. The television device, which is what got my eye, was probably the next thing which I'm keen to talk about. In particular, I've always been skeptical about wireless communications for television applications because it requires so much bandwidth. And if the person next door to me's got their wireless access point going, what's the chance of a bit of interference? You know, that's probably my biggest dilemma.
Why do we need an Apple TV? What is it, Justin? What does it do? Because it's not a television as such, is it?
No, it isn't. Apple have had the AirPort Express out for a while, which is a wireless device that allows you to move your iTunes music to your local stereo wirelessly. And I guess that was really the toe in the water for wireless media devices. This expands that into the TV. So it's high-definition television signal, so it's a HDMI connector, the high-def interface connector. The 720p standard, apparently. Someone else have to explain what that means, but apparently that's quite good. But essentially, it means that if you've got video media on your computers, up to five separate computers in your house, you can have them all stream down to your widescreen TV and out through your stereo speakers. That's essentially what it does. So it doesn't store anything.
It doesn't store anything. It provides an interface between your home computer network and your television and your stereo and everything else you've got in your lounge room.
Which is something I thought I really wanted when I first heard about the product last year, because I have a lot of DVDs that I really rather not necessarily get out of their packages every time I want to watch them, and I've got downloaded video from other areas and so forth, and I thought this is something I'd really like to have. But then you have a look at the details that have been released so far, and you're pretty much restricted with video clips to the MPEG-4 and the H.264 codec, which is the one that is used within iTunes.
Right.
So you have to get your product into iTunes format and then back out again. Now, that's okay for audio, but my experience with the little bit of video that I play with is that every time you transcode the video, you lose some quality or the audio's
out of whack.
Someone
who does that professionally, that is very much the case. There's only a couple of codecs, which are those great little bits of software that do that encoding and decoding for you, which are lossless. But the MPEG-4 codecs that you speak of are very... They're good for the first generation, but boy, do they fall apart after that.
So if I've got a 5-minute AVI file on my network at home of a puppy dog jumping around the backyard that I want to look at on my TV...
I've seen that.
Yeah, you know of the AVI of which I speak. Then this isn't the device for me.
Not at this stage. You'd have to convert it across to a compatible for one of the two compatible formats.
Yeah.
And then it's available. So I was a little disappointed about that, like DivX, all those other formats that are widely available.
Because you can grab your little DVD player these days at the local white goods shop and it'll handle all those sort of things, won't it? But this won't.
And there's other products out there. The iHome has been around for a couple of years now from Elgato Products that does exactly this, but on a much greater number of formats.
I think we're going to look at this in a lot more detail in coming weeks, because there are so many products now that are trying to fill this space in people's lounge rooms, and they all come close and they all do almost a really good job, but there's always something which is letting you down from the complete solution. Like the other thing that comes to
mind, it's almost as if you need a specialist in their field, you know, these home entertainment systems that people are custom build.
Yeah, to look at what your needs are and to get the right product for you. There's Microsoft have got their Media Center, similar sort of concept.
You use that?
I use that. There's the IQ, if you're a Foxtel user, you've got a set-top box there where you can do all this sort of stuff, but again, you can't get access to the network through the IQ. That's more for off-air, for recording and pausing live TV and things like that. So from what you're saying with the Apple TV, it's okay with the Apple format. And if you've got other machines that are networked in your house that are using iTunes.
So in Australia, you're going to be shot in the foot a little bit, aren't you? Because if you can't download any movies from iTunes...
That's right. There's only trailers and some short movies available off iTunes Australia. So if that was the big selling feature, and it probably is in the States, getting TV series before they're released to broadcast media and so forth would be a big attraction. You're just not going to get that in Australia.
If I put on my big picture hat, I would have thought that with the advent of video on demand over broadband and the likes, that this sort of device would have catered for something like this.
At this point, doesn't seem to have. Mind you, it hasn't actually shipped yet. No one's received one that I'm aware of.
It was $299 US. It was pretty cheap. When I think about it.
Or $449 Australian.
Yeah, yeah.
Andrew, video question. Justin said that it'll support 720p HDMI, and I've got a 1080p.
Yeah, 720 is standard def. Wow, okay. To a progressive scan. Progressive is like, there's two types of scanning technologies, progressive and interlaced.
Yeah.
P and I. Now, if you're a standard TV viewer, watcher at home on your standard telly, you'll be watching an interlaced picture. Now, that's all good and fine. If you want to go and have a look at your computer screen, that'll be a progressive picture. So you probably notice that there's a lot sharper image. The scans happen from top to bottom. They don't sort of do the odd scans and then go and refill with even scans. Oh, legacy technology. But
the interlaced is the legacy technology, isn't it?
Yeah, progressive is the new LCD technology that we're sort of seeing today. Because back in the good old days when we had the old cathode ray tubes, you remember those things? They glowed. A little electron beam came out the back of the telly and hit a bit of phosphorus on the glass on the front and it glowed. Well, the reason why we have interlaced is because in the good old days it didn't glow for very long, so they had to overcome this light dark sort of ripple up and down the screen. So they introduced interlace, where they did one line 1357, and then went back and did 2468, and that smoothed out the.
So they've gone Apple have gone the 720p option. Why wouldn't they go the 1080, which is the best of the best?
Bigger files, in just
much
sort of mathematical
more bandwidth required on the wireless link. Yeah,
oh, that's
exactly.
True. Yeah.
If you look at even in an editing point of view, the disc ratio between standard def and high def is about 4:1. So for what you need for standard def, multiply that by 4 for high def.
Mm.
So bigger bandwidth, bigger file sizes, bigger everything, really.
Interesting, but it's good. It supports the HDMI connector on the television for newer televisions, Justin.
It does, and it's got component video as well. The interesting thing, it does have a hard drive. So if you go to the Apple website and have a bit of a read, you'll see that it's got a small 40-gig hard drive, and that's largely so it can sync products out of the iTunes application on your computer. It's not to store it. It's just so that it can, I guess, cache or buffer a little locally towards the television end so you don't get any skips or jumps.
So where to from here, Justin? We're seeing first-generation devices come out of iPhone and ITV. What are we going to see in the next 12 months, do you think?
Yeah, look, it'll be interesting. No doubt the Mac products will continue rolling up, and that's what we're expecting to see over the next month or so with the new version of the Mac OS X operating system. With Apple moving away from their Apple Computer Inc. product, and the new name for the corporation, they're obviously looking to move for other markets. And I guess here we're looking at a couple of different style media products, both using wireless technology, which I guess is...
Wireless is where it's going, isn't it? Mm. Everyone's going to go wireless, whether it be on your portable mobile devices we discussed last week with Tim and Pandora, or even the new Mac.
Yeah, and it would appear really probably over the last 5 years, if not the last decade, that money is actually not necessarily in the hardware product. It's in the online delivery and services. Mm. And I think the iTunes Music Store is obviously a key both for the iPhone and the Apple TV, and I think that's no mistake.
Yeah, and even if you look at Microsoft, I think we've seen the last biggest release of a disk-based operating system. Everything, you know, next-generation stuff's all going to come out over the web as a download, really, isn't it? So it's all going to be that way inclined. Justin, it's been fantastic having you in and having a chat about all things Mac again. We'll have to have you back again sometime soon, especially when we get some more whiz-bang developments.
Thanks
from,
very much.
From the land of... where are they? I assume they're in Silicon Valley, like everybody else seems to be. So, once again, thank you very much. And we'll return very shortly. And we're going to find out, Graham is going to tell us all about what a key net server is. And someone attacked them the other day and what it actually meant to us. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. In your backyard. And worldwide on the pod.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics.
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my own!
If you're like us, in a Tech Talk Radio, you might have a USB memory drive or memory stick hanging off your key ring.
Yep.
What size is it, Andrew? If it's not a personal question.
No, it's not a personal question. It's a gig.
A gig, is it? I thought I was pretty cool having
I thought that was adequate.
I've got a 128 meg one. I thought that was pretty trendy. But
pretty
no,
small, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's about 3 weeks old now, I think. I'm behind the times.
I carry around 2 5-12 ones.
2 5-12s, do you, Graham? Yep. There you go.
I'm with the boys.
These sorts of things are great for great for small data files. But, Andrew, if I told you you could install and run an application like, for example, Adobe Photoshop from your jump drive. Can you see a use for that?
I reckon so. If you head out to a client's place and you don't have to reinstall software, you whack your USB in the slot and away you go.
Exactly right. Lexar have released their Jump Drive Lightning, which is a USB jump drive. It's a 4 gigabyte one.
Why do they call it a jump drive? Any reason?
That's just their brand. Their
trade
marketing.
Name
trademark. Now, not only is it 4 gig, which I thought was fairly huge compared to the little 128 meg, but it also includes Power2Go software. Now, this software provides a portable working environment that lets you install most standard Windows applications and run them from the drive. So you can have personalized settings and bookmarks and everything else with an application that can be accessed from anywhere.
Just thinking about that taking work home too. If you've got something on at work and you want to take home work on it and you don't have the application like a
CAD package or whatever.
Exactly. You install could take it home on your jump drive.
Take it home and use it without infringing a license agreement.
Exactly right. Now, look, these retail for about $130 US or about $167 Australian. I actually saw them advertised at some leading retail outlets in Australia for closer to the $300 mark. I nearly fell off my chair.
Wow.
So it pays to shop around. Shop
any on eBay?
Yeah, eBay and online, yeah.
Yep. So that's the Tech Talk Radio gadget of the week, the Lexar's Jumper Drive Lightning.
Here it is, everybody, the world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
This week's website is one we've talked about before on the show. It's Broadband Choice.
I use it all the time.
So do I.
I used it today.
Did you? Yes. Are you looking for a new ADSL package or
something? For a customer, on behalf of a customer to see if their line was provisioned.
Yeah.
Or able to be provisioned, yeah.
They call themselves Australia's most comprehensive broadband ISP directory. Everything you need if you're a broadband user. If you're looking to work out which ISP to go for, you're getting ADSL for the first time, they'll tell you who's got what plans and what's the cheapest and who's got the features you want. And if you've already got ADSL, they've got user forums where there's not only other users of each of the ISPs, but also in most cases there's representative of the ISP themselves who read the forums.
They've even got a new segment there, a new section as well.
They've got a fantastic news segment. They've got, huge amounts of stuff. They run the broadband survey that we talk about when it comes out every year.
Yep.
They're a great site. If you've got ADSL or broadband, definitely go there and have a look. www.broadbandchoice.com.au.
And even if you're actually in the market for broadband, just as a straight startup, it's fantastic reference.
Key your phone number in, it'll and key in what features you want and how much you're prepared to pay, what speed you want, and it'll give you what ISP is giving you the deal closest to what you want.
Fantastic.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Well, we've all heard of whistleblowers. What's whistleblowers on whistleblowers, Dr. Ron?
The whistle has been blown on whistleblowers, Andrew. A website set up to encourage anonymous leaks of controversial government secrets has ironically been...
Whose government?
Any government.
Oh.
Yes, has been exposed before its launch. Government insiders around the world will be invited to use the site, which is wikileaks.org.
As made by cover, Wikipedia, is it?
Yes, yeah, to leak WikiLeaks. Evidence of corruption and injustice. It is meant to be an adaptation of Wikipedia to encourage whistleblowers to come forward. However, the first major leak at WikiLeaks was a textbook example of the viral word-of-mouth marketing that sets the web a-buzzing. The site itself was the target.
I love it.
Sensational. So have you got a URL for it?
I do. It's www.wikileaks.org.
Fantastic.
It hasn't been launched yet. It's been leaked that it's going to be launched.
Good. Just what we like to hear. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and our guest this evening was Justin Dunlop. We talked all about Macintosh. Next week, more of the same. I'll have Mark Diggins back in, a bit more gossip on Telstra and the likes. Before we go, though, Graham, can you tell us what a net server is? And apparently some people tried to hit it.
Oh, this was the attack this week on a few days ago on some of the DNS servers.
These did it mean anything to anyone or not?
It slowed down some internet access for a day or so. For about 12 hours for everybody worldwide.
Oh, really?
Basically, what they did was there were some bad guys who attacked the main servers. These are the servers that convert the names into the actual IP addresses that that the computers use underneath.
Yep.
So when you look up www.techtalkradio.com.au, these are the root servers where it starts to find out they work from the right
down
to left. So when you go to say, well, who do I talk to about AU domains? It was those root servers that were being slowed down by this attack. They were only slowed down. They weren't actually stopped. So it was a bit of a slowdown, despite the fact that it was a concerted attack over 12 hours.
Fantastic.
Lots of details on the forum. Have a read there.
Have a read. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. We'll be back the same time, same station next week.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. for syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.